shaking his head. I don't know any. I added more scattered details that Pauline had given me about him, including a silly red cravat that he sometimes wore when off duty. Walther's gaze shot up at me.
Mikhail! Of course! I know who he is.
His brows drew together in a rare, menacing way, darkening his whole face.
You aren't involved with him, are you?
No, of course not, but...
Good. Steer clear of his sort. His platoon's been back for 2 weeks. Last I saw of him, he was at the pub, fuller than a tick, with a maid on each knee. That scoundrel's got a sugared tongue and a swooning girl in every town from here to Civica, and he's known to brag about it.
I gaped at him, unable to speak. He grimaced.
Oh, good gods, if it's not you, it's Pauline. She had eyes for him?
I nodded.
Then so much the better that she's free of him now and here with you. He's nothing but trouble. Make sure she stays away from him.
Are you certain, Walther? Mikhail?
He boasts about his conquests and the broken hearts he's left behind, as if they're medals pinned on his chest. I'm certain.
He said his hurried goodbyes with a mindful eye to the growing darkness, but I left mostly in a daze, hardly remembering the steps that took me back to the cottage. She's free of him now.
No, not now. Not ever.
What would I tell her? It would be easier if Mikhail were dead.
Chapter 17. Caden.
So, our princess has a lover. When I followed her into the forest, I thought I was finally going to get what I needed, time alone with her. But the farther she went, the more curious I became. Where could she possibly be going? My mind conjured a lot of possibilities, but never conceived of the one that took me by surprise. I watched her fly into his arms, kissing him, holding him like she'd never let go. The young man was obviously just as happy to see her. They disappeared into the ruins, still tangled in each other's arms. What happened from there wasn't hard for me to imagine. All along, that was what drove her. A lover. That was why she ran from the marriage. I didn't know why I should feel sick. Maybe it was the way she had looked into my eyes this morning. The way she lingered. The blush on her cheeks. It did something to me. Something I liked. Something that made me think maybe things could still be different. I thought about it all day as I rode to Louis Civeque to leave a message. And then all the way back again, even though I tried to banish her from my thoughts. Maybe things could be different. Evidently not. It felt like I had been punched in the gut, a feeling I wasn't accustomed to. I usually guarded myself well in that regard. Wounds in the field were one thing. But these kind, they were sheer stupidity. I may have had the air knocked out of me, but Rafe looked like he had been trampled. Stupid sot. When I turned to leave, he was standing just a dozen feet away, not even trying to hide his presence. He had seen it all. Apparently the smitten jackass had followed us. He didn't speak when I saw him. I suspected he couldn't. I brushed past him. It seems she's true to her word. She isn't the innocent sort, is she? He didn't reply. A reply would have been redundant. His face already said it. Maybe now he'd be on his way, once and for all.
Always on the wind. I hear them coming. Tell me again, Amma, about the storm. There is no time for a story, child. Please, Amma? Her eyes are hollow. There is no supper tonight. A story is all I have to fill her. It was a storm. That's all I remember.
A storm that wouldn't end.
A great storm, she prompts. I sigh. Yes, and pull her to my lap. Once upon a time, child, long, long ago, seven stars were flung from the sky. One to shake the mountains, one to churn the seas, one to choke the air, and four to test the hearts of men. A thousand knives of light grew to an explosive rolling cloud like a hungry monster. Only a little princess found grace. A princess just like you. A storm that made the ways of old meaningless. A sharp knife, a careful aim, an iron will, and a listening heart. Those were the only things that mattered. And moving on. Always moving on. Come, child. It is time to go. The scavengers. I hear them rustling in the hills. The Last Testaments of Gudrell. Chapter 18.
There were so many things I had wanted to say to Pauline today. So many things that seemed important at the time. I was going to lecture her for spreading stories about my fear of rabbits, tease her for her undying resourcefulness even when sick, tell her about Rafe bringing the baskets and my time in the canyon with him. I wanted to ask her what she thought it meant and talk about all the details of our lives, just as we always did at the end of the day when we were back in our room. Now, here I was, alone in the dark, unable to face her, scratching a donkey behind his ears, whispering to him, "What should I do? What should I do?" I had arrived terribly late to the dining room, bursting into the kitchen. Bertie was steaming as much as her kettle of stew. I had intended to tell her why I was late, but all I could utter was, "I have news of Mikhail," before my throat sealed shut. Bertie's steam vanished, and she nodded, handing me a plate. And from there, the evening went by rote, a reprieve from the inevitable. I was so busy there wasn't time for further explanations. I smiled, I welcomed, I delivered, I cleaned. But my spicy words were few. Once I was caught at the watering station, staring at nothing at all, while the mug I was filling spilled over with cider. Pauline touched my elbow and asked if I was all right. "Just tired," I answered. "I had a lot of sun today." She tried to apologize for not helping with the berries, but I cut her short to go deliver the cider. Caden came alone to the dining room. I was relieved that Rafe hadn't come. I was troubled enough without having to navigate his dark moods. Still, I found myself looking at the tavern door each time it opened, thinking he had to eat sooner or later. I tried to smile and offer my standard greetings to everyone, but when I brought Caden his meal, he stopped me before I rushed off. "Your fire seems dampened tonight, Leah." "I'm sorry. I might be a bit distracted. Did I forget something you wanted?"
"Your service is fine. What has you bothered?"
I paused, touched that he perceived my rattled state. "It's only a little throbbing in my head. It will be fine." His eyes remained fixed on me. Apparently he was unconvinced. I sighed and conceded. I'm afraid I received some disheartening news today from my brother.
His brows rose as if this news greatly surprised him.
Your brother is here?
I smiled. Walther, I'd forgotten how happy I had been. He was here for a brief visit this evening. I was overjoyed to see him, but unfortunately we had to part on some difficult news.
A tall fellow? Riding a Tobiano? I think I may have passed him on the highway today.
I was surprised that Walther would take the main highway from Luisavecke and not stick to the back trails.
Yes, that was him, I answered. Caden nodded and sat back in his chair as if he was already satisfied with his meal, though he hadn't yet touched a bite.
I can see the resemblance now that you've told me. The dark hair, the cheekbones.
He had observed much in such a short passing on the road, but then again, he had already proved himself observant when he noted my lack of fire in a bustling tavern. He leaned forward.
Is there anything I can do?
His voice was warm and slow, and reminded me of the gentle rumble of a distant summer storm, so inviting at a distance. And those eyes again, the ones that made me feel naked, like he saw beneath my skin. I knew I couldn't sit down and tell him my worries, but his steadfast gaze made me want to.
Nothing, I whispered.
He reached out and squeezed my hand. More silent seconds ticked between us. I need to be about my duties, Caden. Glancing across the room, I saw Bertie watching from the kitchen door and wondered what she must think, then wondered who else saw. And really, was it anything I should feel guilty about? Wasn't it good to know someone was worried about me when others were seeking to put a rope about my neck? I was grateful for his kindness, but I pulled my hand from his.
Thank you, I whispered, afraid my voice might crack, and I hurried away.
When our evening work was done, I left Pauline gaping at the kitchen door as I rushed out by myself, claiming I needed fresh air and was going for a walk. But I didn't walk. I got only as far as Otto's stall. It was dark and deserted, and my worries would be safe with him. I balanced on the top rail of the stall, hugging a post with one hand and scratching his ears with the other. He didn't question my late-night attentions. He accepted them gratefully, which made my chest pull tighter. I struggled to choke back sobs. What should I do? The truth would kill her. I heard a rustle, the hollow thump of metal. I froze, looking into the darkness. Who's there? There was no answer. And then more noise, seemingly from a different direction. I reeled, confused, jumped from the rail, and called out again. Who's there? In a slash of moonlight, Pauline's pale face appeared.
It's me. We need to talk.
Chapter 19. Rafe.
It wasn't my intention to witness what I did. If I could have moved quietly away, I would have. But I was trapped. It seemed that in one day, I had witnessed far more by chance than by intention. I had gone to a pub in town for my evening meal, not wanting to encounter the princess again. I had had enough for one day, enough of her royal conniving antics altogether. I'd already told myself she was in imperious pain. Better for me that she was. It was easier to keep my distance that way. But as I drank my third cider and barely touched my food, I found I was still trying to sort through what happened, and with each sip, I damned her again. Only this morning, when I had seen her in the canyon, I was tongue-tied. She'd looked just like any other girl out gathering berries.
her hair braided back, loose strands brushing her neck, her cheeks flushed with heat. No pretense, no royal airs, no secrets that I didn't already know. Words had run through my mind trying to describe her, but none seemed quite right. I had sat like a witless fool on the back of my horse, just staring. And then she invited me to stay. As we walked, I knew I was going down a dangerous path, but that didn't stop me. At first, I kept all my words in check, carefully doled out. But then, in an uncanny way, she pulled them from me anyway. It all seemed very easy and innocent, until it wasn't. I should have known. Up on the cliff, when there was nowhere else to go, when our words seemed to matter less and our proximity mattered more, when I couldn't force my gaze away from her to save my life, my mind raced with one possibility and one possibility only. I stepped closer. There was a moment, a long, breath-holding moment. But then, with a few venomous words from her, a terrible mistake, the marks of grunting barbarians, I was slammed with the truth. She was not just any 17-year-old girl, and I wasn't any young man helping her pick berries. Our worlds were not similar at all. I had been deluding myself. She had one goal. I had another. She practically spat her condemning words out, and I felt venom surge through me, too. I remembered how different we both were, and no distant walk could change that. The more I drank, the foggier my anger became. But then flashes of her clandestine rendezvous in the forest would surface to sharpen it again. What had pushed me to follow Caden? As I watered my horse, I saw him slip down the path toward her cottage, and soon I was on his heels. What did I expect? Not what I saw. It explained everything. She has a lover. I knew I had been entertaining a dangerous fantasy. After 4 ciders, I paid my bill and returned to the inn. It was late, and I didn't think I'd run into anyone. I made a last trip to the privy after unsaddling my horse and was headed for the loft when she appeared, coming down the path, hell-bent, her cap clutched in her fist like a weapon and her hair flying behind her. I stepped into a shadowed corner by the stalls, waiting for her to pass, but she didn't. She stopped only feet from me, climbing onto the rail where the jackass was stabled. It was obvious she was distraught, more than distraught, fearful. I had come to think she wasn't afraid of anything. I watched, her lips half parted, her breathing uneven, as she whispered to the donkey, caressing his ears, raking her fingers through his mane, whispering words so strained and low I couldn't hear them, even though with just a few steps I could have reached out and touched her. I looked at her face, gently illuminated by the distant light of the tavern. Even with her brows pulled low and an anguished crease between them, she was beautiful. It was a strange thing to think at the moment. I had deliberately avoided the thought each time I had looked at her before. I couldn't afford such thoughts. But now the word came, unbidden, unrelenting. I saw more than I was sure she wanted anyone to see. She cried, tears flowed down her cheeks, and she angrily wiped them away. But then, whatever grieved her made the tears inconsequential, and they flowed freely. I wanted to step out of the darkness, ask her what was wrong, but quickly suppressed that impulse and questioned my own sanity or maybe sobriety. She was not to be trusted, flirting with me one moment, meeting a lover the next. I had to remind myself that I didn't care what her troubles were. I needed to leave. I tried to slide away unnoticed, but the ciders at the pub were strong, and I wasn't feeling surest of foot. My boot knocked an unseen pail. "Who's there?" she called out. I thought the deception was over and was about to make myself known when the other girl approached, covering my presence. "It's me," she said. "We need to talk." I was frozen in their world, their worries, their words. I was trapped, and all I could do was listen.
Chapter 20.
He came out of nowhere. One moment not there, the next there, scooping Pauline into his arms.
"I'll take her to the cottage," he said, almost as a question.
I nodded, and he left with me trailing just behind him. Pauline was limp in his arms, moaning, inconsolable. Just before we reached the cottage, I raced ahead, flinging open the door, turning up the light of the lantern, and he carried her inside. I pointed to the bed, and he gently laid her on the mattress. She curled into a tight ball facing the wall. I brushed the tangled mop of hair from her face and touched her cheek. "Pauline, what can I do?" What had I already done? She moaned between sobs, and the only words that were understandable were, "Go away. Please go away." I stared at her, unable to move. I couldn't leave her. I watched her trembling and reached for a blanket, gingerly tucking it around her, stroking her forehead, wishing to take her pain away. I leaned close and whispered, "I'll stay with you, Pauline, through everything. I promise." Again, her only discernible words were, "Go away, leave me alone," each one a stab in my chest. I heard the scuff of Rafe's boots on the floor and realized he was still in the room. He inclined his head toward the door, suggesting that we step outside. I turned the lantern down and followed him, numb, quietly easing the door shut behind us. I leaned back against it, needing its support. What had I said? How had I said it? Did I just blurt the words out cruelly? Still, what else could I have done? I had to tell her something sooner or later. I tried to retrace every word. "Leah," Rafe whispered, lifting my chin to look at him, reminding me of his presence. "Are you all right?" I shook my head. "I didn't want to tell her." I looked at him, uncertain of what he had heard. "Were you there? Did you hear?" He nodded. "You had no choice but to tell her the truth." The truth. I had told her Mikhail was dead. But wasn't that the lesser of two evils? He wasn't coming for her. He was never coming. If I had told her the truth, all the dreams she held dear would be gone. They would all be illusions, false at their very roots. She'd know she had been played for a fool. She'd have nothing left to hold on to, only bitterness to harden her heart. This way, couldn't she at least have tender memories of him to warm her? Which truth was more cruel? His deception and betrayal, or his death?
"I should go," Rafe whispered.
I glanced back at him. He was so close I could smell the cider on his breath, could feel his pulse, the gallop of his thoughts, every nerve in me raw, the night itself closing in on me. I grabbed his arm. "No," I said. "Please, don't go yet." He looked at where my hand grasped his arm, and then back at me. His lips parted, his eyes warmed. But then slowly, something else filled them, something cold and rigid, and he pulled away. "It's late." "Of course," I said, dropping my hand to my side, holding it there awkwardly like it didn't belong to me. "I only wanted to thank you before you left. If you hadn't happened along, I don't know what I would have done." His only response was a nod, and then he disappeared down the trail. I spent the night sitting in the corner chair staring at Pauline. I tried not to disturb her. For an hour, she stared at the wall, then guttural sobs racked her chest, then mewing cries like those of an injured kitten escaped from her lips, and finally soft, gentle moans of "Mikhail, Mikhail, Mikhail" filled the room, as if he were there and she was talking to him. If I tried to comfort her, she pushed me away. So I sat, offering water when I could, offering prayers, offering and offering, but nothing I did took away her pain. Just this morning I'd been afraid that I might never meet the young man who loved her so. Now I feared if I ever did meet him, I would cut out his heart with a dull knife and feed it to the gulls. Finally, in the early morning hours, she slept, but I still stared. I remembered my ride past the graveyard with Pauline this morning. I had known. Fear had seized me. Something was wrong. Something was hopelessly and irretrievably wrong. My flesh had crawled. Warning breezes. A candle. A prayer. A hope. An icy whisper. A cold, clawed hand on my neck. I hadn't understood what it had meant, but I had known.
Chapter 21.
The next several days went by in a flurry of emotion and chores. Endless chores, which I was happy to take on. The morning after the news, Pauline woke up, washed her face, fished 3 coins from her meager savings of tips, and left for the sacrista. She was there all day, and when she returned, she was wearing a white silk scarf draped over her head, the mourning symbol reserved for widows. While she was gone, I told Birdie and Gwyneth that Mikhail was dead. Gwyneth hadn't even known he existed, and neither had heard Pauline's heartfelt stories about him, so they couldn't quite grasp how she had been affected, until she returned from the sacrista. Her skin matched the color of the white silk that cascaded down around her face, a pale ghost except for her puffy, red-rimmed eyes. She looked more like a gaunt ghoul returned from the graveyard than the sweet young maid she had been only the day before. What worried us more than her appearance was her refusal to talk. She accepted Birdie's and Gwyneth's concerns and comforts stoically enough, but shook away more than that, spending most of the days on her knees, offering one holy remembrance after another for Mikhail, lighting one candle after another, feverish in lighting his way into the next world. Birdie noted that at least she was eating, not much, but enough for basic sustenance. I knew why. That was for Mikhail, too, and what they still shared. If I had told Pauline the truth about him, would she have cared enough even to touch her food? We all agreed we would help her through this, each of us taking on a portion of Pauline's workload, and we gave her the space she asked for and the time to observe the mourning due a widow. We knew she wasn't a true widow, but who else was to know? We wouldn't tell. I was hurt at being shut out, but I had never lost the love of my life. And that was what Mikhail had been to her. With the festival little more than 2 weeks away, there was more work to be done than usual. And without Pauline to help, we worked from dawn until the last meal was served in the evening. I thought of the days back at the Citadel when I'd lie awake, unable to sleep, musing about one thing or another, usually an injustice perpetrated by someone with more power than I, and that included just about everyone. I didn't have that problem now. I slept deep and hard, and if the cottage had caught fire, I would have burned right along with it. In spite of the increased workload, I still saw Wraith and Caden often. In fact, at every turn, one of them seemed to be there, offering assistance with a wash basket or helping me unload supplies from Otto. Gwyneth teased on the sly about their convenient attentions, but it never went further than being helpful. Mostly. One day I heard Caden roaring with a vengeance. When I ran from cleaning the rooms to see what was wrong, he was emerging from the barn, holding his shoulder and sending up a string of hot curses at Rafe's horse. It had nipped him on the front of his shoulder, and blood was seeping through his shirt. I led him to the steps of the tavern and pushed on his good shoulder to make him sit, trying to calm him. I undid the first button of his shirt and pulled it aside to look at the wound. The horse had barely broken the skin, but an ugly, palm-sized bruise was already swelling and turning blue. I ran to the ice house and returned with several chips wrapped in cloth and held it to the wound. "I'll get some bandages and salve," I said. He insisted it wasn't necessary, but I insisted louder, and he relented. I knew where Bertie kept the supplies, and when I returned, he watched every move I made. He said nothing as I applied the ointment with my fingers, but I felt his muscles tense at my touch as I gently pressed the bandage in place with my hand. I placed the pack of ice chips back on top, and he reached up, holding my palm against his shoulder with his own, as if he was holding on to something more than just my hand.
"Where did you learn to do that?" he asked.
I laughed. "Apply a bandage? A simple kindness needn't be learned, and I grew up with older brothers, so there were always bandages being applied to one of us or another." His fingers squeezed around mine, and he stared at me, I thought searching for some sort of thank you, but then I knew it was more than that. Something deep and tender and private lurked in his dusky eyes. He finally released my hand and looked away, a tinge of pink at his temples. With his gaze still averted, he whispered a simple, "Thank you." His reaction was puzzling, but the color faded as quickly as it had come, and he pulled his shirt back over his shoulder as if it hadn't happened. "You're a kind soul, Caden," I said. "I'm sure it will heal quickly." When I was halfway through the door to return the unused supplies, I turned and asked, "What language was that?" "The curses. I didn't recognize it." His mouth hung half open, and his expression was blank.
"Only nonsense words my grandmother taught me," he said, "meant to spare a coin of penance."
It hadn't sounded like nonsense to me. It had sounded like angry, real words said in the heat of the moment. "I need to learn some of those words. You must teach me one day so I can spare my coins, too." The corners of his mouth lifted in a stiff smile. "One day I will." With the days growing warmer, I appreciated Rafe's and Caden's help even more, but it made me wonder why they had no work of their own to attend to. They were young and able, and while they both had very nice steeds and tack, they didn't seem wealthy, yet they paid Bertie cheerfully for the loft, board, and stabling of their horses. Neither one ever seemed to run short of coin. Could an out-of-work farmhand and an idle trader have that much money saved? I would have questioned their lack of direction more, but most of Taravin was full of summer visitors who were only biding their time until the festival,
including the other guests at the inn, many journeying in from lonely hamlets, isolated farms, and apparently, in Rafe's case, regions with no names. Rafe did say that his lack of work as a farmhand was temporary. Maybe his employer was only taking a break for the festival, which also gave him free time. Not that either he or Caden was lazy. They were both always eager to pitch in. Caden fixing the wheel on Birdie's wagon without any prompting, and Rafe proving himself as an experienced farmhand, clearing the trenches in Birdie's vegetable garden and repairing its sticky sluice gate. Gwyneth and I both watched with more than a little interest as he swung the hoe and lifted heavy rocks to reinforce the channel. Perhaps, like other festival-goers, they appreciated this chance for a break from the usual drudgery and routine of their lives. The festival was both sacred obligation and welcome respite in the middle of summer. The town was decorated with colorful flags and ribbons, and doorways were draped with long garlands of pine sprigs in anticipation of the celebrations that would commemorate the deliverance. The days of debauchery, my brothers called it, noting that their friends observed in greatest earnest the drinking portion of the festivities. The festival lasted for 6 days. The first day was for holy rites, fasting and prayer, the second for food, games, and dancing. Each of the remaining 4 days were given to prayer and acts to honor the four gods who had gifted Morrigan and delivered the remnant. As members of the royal court, our family had always kept strict festival schedules set by the timekeeper, observing all the sacraments, the fast, the feasts, and dancing, all given just and proper time. But I was no longer a member of any court. This year I could set my own schedule and attend the events I chose. I wondered which portion of the festivities Caden and Rafe would most indulge in. For all his attentions, Rafe still kept a measured distance. It made no sense. He could avoid me altogether if he chose, but he didn't. Maybe he was just filling his time until the festival, but more than once, in one task or another, our fingers touched or our arms brushed, and fire would race through me. One day, as I walked out the tavern door, he was entering, and we stumbled into each other, our faces so close our breath mingled. I forgot about where I was going. I thought I saw tenderness in his eyes, if not passion, and wondered if the same fire raced through him. As with our other encounters, I waited and hoped, trying not to spoil the moment, but just like the others, it vanished too as Rafe remembered something else he needed to tend to, and I was left confused and breathless. Every day we seemed to share some sort of banter, maybe several times in one day. As I swept a porch outside a room, he'd appear as if on his way somewhere, and then pause and lean against a post, asking how Pauline was doing, or if there might be a room opening up soon, or whatever topic served the moment. I wanted to lean on my broom and talk endlessly to him, but to what end? Sometimes I'd just forget about hoping for more, and enjoy his company and closeness. I figured if things were meant to be, they happened sooner rather than later, and I tried to put it out of my mind. But in the stillness of the night, I hung on our conversations. As I drifted off to sleep, I dwelled on each word we shared, thinking about every expression on his face, wondering what I was doing wrong. Maybe the problem had been me all along. Maybe I was destined to be unkissed. Unkissable. But as I lay there wondering, I would hear Pauline sleeping fitfully next to me, and I'd be ashamed of my shallow worries. One day, after listening to Pauline toss and whimper through most of the night, I viciously attacked the spider webs in the eaves of the guest room porches, imagining Mikhail sleeping off another all-nighter at a pub with a new girl in his lap.
He's nothing but trouble. Make sure she stays away from him. But still, a soldier in the Royal Guard. It sickened me. A soldier with a sugar-coated tongue and an angelic face, but a heart as black as night. I took his deception out on every eight-legged creature that hung from the rafters. Rafe happened by and asked which spider was responsible for putting me in such a foul mood. None of these crawling vermin, I'm afraid. But there's one with two legs to whom I'd gladly take a club instead of a broom. I didn't mention names, but told him of a fellow who had deceived a young woman, playing games with her heart. Surely everyone makes a mistake on occasion. He took the broom from me and proceeded to calmly swipe down the webs that were out of my reach. His unruffled sweeping maddened me. Deliberate deception is not a mistake. It's calculating and cold, I told him, especially when aimed at the one you profess to love. He paused mid-swipe, as if I had swatted him on the back of the head. And if one can't be trusted in love, I added, one can't be trusted in anything. He stopped and lowered the broom, turning to look at me. He seemed struck by what I'd said, absorbing it as if it were a proclamation deep and profound, instead of a hateful rant against a horrible person after a sleepless night. He leaned on the broom, and my stomach flipped over as it always did when I looked at him. A sheen of sweat lit his face.
I'm sorry for what your friend's been through, he said. But deception and trust, are they really so unconditional?
Yes.
You've never been guilty of deception?
Yes, but
so there are conditions.
Not when it comes to love and gaining a person's affections. His head tilted in acknowledgement.
Do you suppose your friend feels the same way? Will she ever forgive him for the deception?
My heart still ached for Pauline. It ached for me. I shook my head. Never, I whispered. Some things can't be forgiven. His eyes narrowed, as if contemplating the gravity of the unforgivable. That was what I both hated and loved about Rafe. He challenged me on everything I said, but he also listened intently. He listened as if every word I said mattered.
Chapter 22.
Though it was already midsummer, the real summer heat arrived at last at the seaside, and I found myself stopping more often to splash my face with water from the pump. In Civica, sometimes summer didn't arrive at all, the fog rolling in over the hills year-round. Only when we traveled inland for a hunt did we experience any kind of true heat. Now I understood why the thin shifts worn by the local girls were not only appropriate, but necessary here. The few clothes Pauline and I had brought with us from Civica were woefully inadequate for the weather of Terravin, but sleeveless chemises or dresses, I had already learned, presented problems of a different kind. I couldn't be walking around Terravin with a blazing royal wedding kavah on my shoulder. I recruited Gwyneth, some strong laundry soap, and one of Bertie's stiff potato brushes to help me. It was a hot day, so Gwyneth was happy to comply, and we went to the creek shallows. She stood behind me and examined the kavah, brushing her fingers along my back. Most of it's gone, you know, except for this small bit on your shoulder. I sighed. It's been well over a month. It should all be gone by now. It's still quite pronounced. I'm not sure here, I said, holding the potato brush over my shoulder. Don't be afraid to put muscle into it. Bertie will skin you if she finds you using one of her kitchen brushes. My back is dirtier than a potato? She grunted and set to work. I tried not to flinch as she rubbed the stiff brush and harsh soap against my skin.
After a few minutes, she splashed water on my shoulder to rinse away the suds and take a look at the progress. She sighed. Are you sure it was only a kava and not something more permanent? I swam out into deeper water and faced her. Nothing? She shook her head. I dipped below the surface, my eyes open, looking at the blurred world above me. It made no sense. I'd had decorative kavas painted on my hands and face dozens of times for various celebrations, and they were always gone within a week or two. I surfaced and wiped the water from my eyes. Try again. The corner of her mouth pulled down. It's not coming off, Leah. She sat down on a submerged stone that peeked from the water like a turtle's shell. Maybe the priest cast some magic into his words as part of the rites. Kavas follow the rules of reason, too, Gwyneth. There is no magic. The rules of reason bow to magic every day, she countered, and might have little regard for the small magic of a stubborn kava on one girl's shoulder. Are you sure the artisans did nothing different? I'm certain. Still, I searched my memories for something. I couldn't see the artisans as they worked, but I knew the design was all done at the same time with the same brushes and same dyes. I remembered my mother reaching out to comfort me during the ceremony, but instead I felt her touch as a hot sting on my shoulder. Did something go wrong then? And there had been the prayer, the one in Mother's native tongue that wasn't tradition. May the gods gird her with strength, shield her with courage, and may truth be her crown. It was an odd prayer, but vague, and surely the words themselves had no power. It's not so bad, really, and there's no indication that it's royal or even a wedding kava anymore. The crest of Dalbrek and the royal crowns are gone. It's only a partial claw and vines. It could be there for any reason. Can't you live with that? Live with a scrap of Dalbrek's crest peeking over my shoulder for the rest of my life? Not to mention it was the claw of a vicious mythological animal not even found in Morrigan folklore. Still, I remembered when I first saw the kava. I had thought it was exquisite. Perfection, I had called it. But that was when I thought it would soon be washed away, when I didn't know it would serve as a permanent reminder of the life I had thrown away. You'll always be you, Leah. You can't run from that. It will come off, I told her. I'll just give it more time. She shrugged, and her gaze rose to the golden leaves of a lacy tree branching out above us, hemmed in by the vibrant green of others. She smiled, bittersweet. Look at the brilliant yellow. Autumn is greedy, no? Already stealing days from summer. I eyed the premature color. Early, yes, but maybe it all evens out. Maybe there are times summer lingers and refuses to give way to autumn. She sighed. The rules of reason. Even nature can't obey. She stripped off her clothes, throwing them carelessly on the bank. She joined me in the deeper waters, dipping below the surface and then twisting her thick cords of burgundy hair into a long rope. Her milky white shoulders hovered just above the surface. "Will you ever go back?" she asked bluntly. I had heard the rumors of war. I knew Gwyneth had, too. She still thought that as first daughter I could change things. That door had never been opened to me. And now there was no doubt it was firmly shut. But she probably saw the stubborn kava as a sign, and I wondered how hard she had really tried to scrub it away. She stared at me, waiting for my answer. Will you ever go back? I dipped below the water, and the world grew muted again, the golden leaves above me barely visible, the dull echo of my heart beating in my temples, bubbles of air escaping from my nose.
and soon Gwyneth's question was gone, carried away in the current of the creek, along with all of its expectations.
Chapter 23. The Assassin.
I peered through the window. I couldn't wait much longer. In a few days, my comrades would be here, ready to return to Venda. They'd howl like a pack of dogs if the deed still wasn't done, eager to be on their way and scornful that I had taken so long over a single small task. One girl's throat. Even could have managed that. But it wouldn't be one girl. I'd have to kill them both. I watched them sleeping. I had the eyes of a cat, the Komazar claimed, seeing in darkness what no one else could. Maybe that was what destined me for this purpose. Grizz was a stomping bull and more suited to the loud work of an axe on a bridge or a bloody daylight raid. Not for this kind of work. Not for the silent steps of a night animal. Not for becoming a shadow that pounced with swift precision. But they slept in the same bed, their hands touching. Even I couldn't be that silent. Death made noises of its own. I looked at Leah's throat. Open. Exposed. Easy. But this time, it wouldn't be easy. After the festival, I could wait until then.
Chapter 24. The Prince.
Only their feet were visible beneath the curtain of dripping sheets that hung from the line, but I could hear them well enough. I had come to pay Birdie for my week's lodging before I left for Luisaveki. It was the nearest town where messages could be sent and the couriers were discreet for a sufficient price. I paused, looking at Leah's boots as she went about her work. Damn it if everything about her doesn't fascinate me. The leather was worn and dirty, and they were the only shoes I had ever seen her wear. She didn't seem to care. Maybe growing up with three older brothers gave her different sensibilities from the girls of noble breeding I had known. Either she had never acted like a princess, or she rejected every aspect of being one when she arrived here. She'd have made a miserable fit for the court of Dalbrek, where the protocol of dress was elevated to laborious and religious proportions. I fumbled for the Morrigan notes in my pocket to give to Birdie. Leah's hands reached down below the bottom edge of the sheet, and she pulled another piece of wet laundry from the basket. "Were you ever in love, Birdie?" she asked. I stopped, my hands still shoved in my pocket. Birdie was silent for a long while. "Yes," she finally said, "a long time ago." "You didn't marry?" "No. We were very much in love, though. By the gods, he was handsome. Not in the usual sense. His nose was hooked, his eyes set close, and there wasn't a lot of hair up on top. But he lit up the room when he walked in. He had what I called presence." "What happened?" Birdie was an old woman, and yet I noticed she sighed as if the memory were fresh. "I couldn't leave here, and he couldn't stay. That pretty much tells it all." Leah questioned her more, and Birdie told her the man was a stonecutter with a business in the City of Sacraments. He'd wanted her to come away with him, but her mother had passed on. Her father was getting older, and she was afraid to leave him alone with the tavern to run. "Do you regret not going?" "I can't think about things like that now. What's done is done. I did what I had to do at the time." Birdie's knobby hand reached down for a handful of pegs. "But what if... Why don't we talk about you for a while? Birdie asked. Are you still happy with your decision to leave home now that you've had some time here? I couldn't be happier. And once Pauline is feeling better, I'll be delirious. Even though some people still think the tradition and duty of... Stop! Those are two words I never want to hear again. I heard Leah say, tradition and duty. I don't care what others think. Birdie grunted. Well, I suppose in Dalbrecht they aren't, and that's the third word I never want to hear again. Ever. Dalbrecht. I crumpled the notes in my fist, listening, feeling my pulse rush. They were as much a cause of my problems as anyone. What kind of prince? Her voice cut off, and there was a long silence. I waited, and finally I heard Birdie say gently, It's all right, Leah. You can talk about it. The silence continued, and when Leah finally spoke again, her voice was weak. All my life, I dreamed about someone loving me, for who I was. Not the king's daughter. Not first daughter. Just me. And certainly not because a piece of paper commanded it. She nudged the laundry basket with her boot. Is it asking too much to want to be loved? To look into someone's eyes and see... Her voice cracked and there was more silence. And see tenderness. To know that he truly wants to be with you and share his life with you. I felt the hot blood drain from my temples, my neck suddenly damp. I know some nobility still have arranged marriages, she went on. But it isn't so common anymore. My brother married for love. Greta's not even a first daughter. I thought one day I'd find someone too, until... Her voice broke again. Go on, Birdie said. You've held it in far too long. You might as well get it all out. Leah cleared her throat, and her words rushed out hot and earnest. Until the King of Dalbrecht proposed the marriage to the cabinet. It was his idea. Do I look like a horse, Birdie? I'm not a horse for sale. Of course you're not, Birdie agreed. And what kind of man allows his papa to secure a bride for him? No man at all. He couldn't even be bothered to come see me before the wedding, she sniffed. He didn't care who he married. I might as well have been an old brood mare. He's nothing more than a princely papa's boy following orders. I could never have a morsel of respect for a man like that. That's understandable. Yes, I supposed it was. I shoved the notes back into my pocket and left. I would pay Birdie later.
Only a small remnant of the whole earth remained. They endured three generations of testing and trial, winnowing the purest from those who still turned toward darkness. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 4. Chapter 25.
I strolled through Terravin, swinging a stringed bundle in each hand. One for me, and one for Pauline. I didn't need Otto to carry these light loads, and I wanted the freedom of venturing down pathways and avenues at a leisurely pace, so today I walked to town on my own. With all in order at the inn, Birdie told me to take the day and spend it as I chose. Pauline still passed her days at the Sacrista, so I went alone with only one acquisition in mind. I might have to wait for the kava to fade, but that didn't mean I had to wear my ragged trousers, heavy skirts, or long-sleeved shirts until it was gone. It was a mere piece of decoration on my shoulder now, with no hint of royalty or betrothal, and whether it stayed or went, I wouldn't let it rule my dress one more day. I walked down near the docks and the smell of salt, fish, wet timber, and the fresh red paint on the tackle shop swirled on the breeze. It was a healthy, robust smell that suddenly made me smile. It made me think, I love Terravan.